Mini episode 1839 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode 1838. You have with you here today FDH Lounge dignitaries Rick Morris and Ben Chu. Ben, of course, our FDH Hoops analyst, and we are here today to talk about the 2025 NBA draft and to take a little bit of a preview and overview of it. Obviously, the big story of the draft is Cooper Flagg going to Dallas with the first pick and the various improbabilities associated with that, if you're picking up what I'm putting down, but many other different elements of this intriguing draft class, a draft class that is certainly better than what we saw a year ago. It is more promising, and it has some very intriguing questions, even among the guys who are going to have to be developed considerably or even a little bit here. So, but Ben, always great to have you in. And this draft class, again, we took a look at it during the we did a live show during the lottery, and I know we're looking forward to looking at the draft in real time on draft night. But here for our preview today, a lot of interesting different angles we can get into.
Oh yeah, there's a bunch this year, and I feel like Rick just deleted off that this draft has a lot of similarities to the 2020 NBA draft. So,
okay,
we'll see what ends up happening with which class is going to be better at the end of the day.
Okay, very interesting. That was one where there was not necessarily a consensus number one player. It ended up being Anthony Edwards, who went first to Minnesota. And looking back on it here, because again, it could have been James Wiseman going in that spot. And as a Golden State hater, I was very bitter that they ended up getting the second pick and ending up taking him. But again, from my Golden State hating heart, it couldn't have worked out any better the way that it went. I shudder to think if Anthony Edwards had dropped the two, what would have happened there? Because we've been talking about this, the turnover of teams at the top of the NBA, that the teams of the powers of the mid to late 2010s, with Boston suffering the Jason Tatum injury, this is basically kind of the end of an era. We've seen the transition to the new era fully going here with Oklahoma City and Indiana in the NBA Finals. That really kind of exemplifies it, that the league is turning the page here. But Golden State would have been an exception to that, and they would have been a power the rest of the decade and potentially beyond had they had Anthony Edwards fall into their lap.
Right, and again, too, this was – there's also discussions. The third pick, LaMelo Ball, was potentially going there. It was a lot of people said it was going to be an interesting fit if he did, but that was also possibilities. So there's a little bit of similarities in this draft. There's a little bit. We have, at least in discussion in this draft, a much clearer cut number one in Cooper Flagg, who, I mean, we've been talking about Cooper Flagg since 2022, 2023. So this shouldn't really shock anyone, but rest of this draft is kind of a hodgepodge of a bunch of different guys who did well during the college basketball season. Some that have high watermarks in terms of what they did in the tournament. But essentially the top three, it's still, there's still a lot of movement going on. And at this, you know, at two and three right now, still a bit of question marks on whether essentially Ace Bailey and Dylan Harper are going to live up to that potential at this point.
That's right, and it was a huge, at least on a team level, if not an individual level, a huge underachievement for Rutgers this past season, and not even make the NCAA tournament when they have the consensus number two pick in the draft here, Dylan Harper, the combo guard, and the guy who is not necessarily quite the consensus number three overall pick, but the somewhere around the beginning of that next tier. The next tier seems to go from three to about seven. And Ace Bailey, the swing man, is right there at that point. He is somebody that is projecting to go as high as three, should go no later than four or five. Somehow or another,
Rutgers, I actually think he could go later than that at this point. this
point. Oh,
internal discussions right now.
Okay.
That apparently he has been declining some invites to go work out. So we will see. There was a room he was supposed to work out today in Philly, but he apparently that was canceled. I don't know if that was rescheduled or not. But there has been some murmuring around that he may be not intentionally. I would never think anyone's trying to intentionally hurt their draft stock. But I could totally see a scenario where he's within range of a couple of teams like the Wizards and the Pelicans who may be holistically viewed by him as a better fit. And again, there's also questions too. And again, the other guy that has been around as well that a lot of people have been talking about is VJ Edgecombe from Baylor. Or Trey Johnson from Texas has also been in that world too. And it's a very interesting time with Philadelphia right now. So on paper, Bailey makes the most sense. And they've even, like, Morey has come out and said that even if he doesn't work out for them, they would still be intent on drafting him. I don't know if that's a smokescreen, if that's just people trade you. Possibly trying to get a deal worked out for someone a little bit lower, try and get more stuff for him. But at this point, it kind of feels like the only things that we know for sure right now is that Flag's going one, and Harper, barring San Antonio trading out of the spot, they're going to take him and feel very confident in taking him at this time.
Yes, and we did say, I said in real time on draft night when San Antonio ended up with that pick there and looking at it that, again, they've got an already crowded backcourt. So, I mean, the pieces are all there as far as if anybody could make any kind of a worthy offer to Milwaukee for the Greek Freak, it would be San Antonio. You put Dylan Harper in the deal, potentially Castle in there, bundle in some other picks, maybe some other players as well. I mean, San Antonio has the perfect combination if Milwaukee is amenable to turning the page here. And that's the $64,000 question is if they are, because I really don't think anybody could knock San Antonio out of the water as far as what they have. Philadelphia for three, Ace Bailey. Yeah, I mean, if he's declining any invitations, I mean, obviously that is a consequence-free thing to do. Is to turn down teams and snub them. Let's just go ask Shedeur Sanders, right?
All right. And I mean, the real question too is, and again, that we're in silly season right now, just before the
draft. Yes. Yes.
These are just reports. And again, even though these sources are pretty well confirmed, I also have to note that I kind of understand the logic is that if I was Bailey himself, I'm not 100% sure I'd want to go to Philadelphia. If I feel like I could potentially have a bigger role on another team down the line. But again, this is silly season. I don't think we should read a lot into it, but I do also think that very similarly to Shador's situation, he hasn't exactly been open with where he wants to play, but it almost feels like too that there's at least within his agent and with his internal personal team, some discussion about maybe Philly isn't the best spot for me if I want to be, you know, like essentially, because again, we tend to forget, especially during these drafts, that we look at players and we think, well, you know, he's going to a great team. Why wouldn't you want to go there? Well, if you're an 18, 19, 20 year old, I might want a bigger role on a team that maybe might not be as good, but then I would get the opportunity to be the star, which then incentivizes the franchise to give me a better contract down the line. So
yeah, possibly. But again, he does fit very well with Philadelphia, and he fits well, again, regardless of, you and I have talked about this off air, regardless of the direction that they want to go, because I would kind of tend to look at it and say, I'm not exactly sure you could pawn off Embiid's contract on anybody, but if you could, and Paul George, even if you got to attach picks to it, build around Maxey, build around McCain, and build around Ace Bailey. I mean, you're in a good situation there. Or if they stay status quo and you put Ace Bailey in there, I think you can play both him and Paul George in the front court alongside one another. I mean, that's a darn good starting five for the 15 games a year or so that everybody is healthy out there. And that, you know, if you go into the playoffs with everybody healthy, I mean, it's a very good starting five. So, I mean, either way, he fits very well there versus the perennial losers like Charlotte and Washington. New Orleans is just a mess with their roster. So it's like dropping to one of those teams there. I mean, being higher on the totem pole of an absolute shite squad? Is that really what you want?
I mean, it's ultimately a question that, again, it comes down to the player. Because, and again, one thing we also have to know too, Rick, these are 18, 19, 20-year-olds having to be essentially advised by older people who, the end goal for a lot of people when, whether it's your agent, whether it's your manager, whether it's anyone down the line, they want you to make as much money as possible.
Yes.
So if they can direct you to a team, like, and we've seen this in the draft before. We saw essentially what happened with Steve Francis at Vancouver. That was more of a location scenario, but it was more also, too, that he could get to be the guy with the Houston Rockets. So it's unusual mainly because we've seen it much more in the NFL draft where guys have kind of forced their way to a certain team in comparison to the NBA where it's more about player empowerment, but it's pretty rare. And I think Bailey's situation is unique because he's still kind of a, at least on tape, a tough shot-making big guy who can spread the floor if need be. But the problem at Rutgers, there's multiple times where he would kind of disappear in games. He wasn't exactly, you know, out in front. But again, it's always tough with college basketball to determine into the NBA just because of how stylistically everything is. And again, he also had to defer to Harper a little bit during his timeline as well. So if you look at it, I feel like if you were to ask just overall, like, where would you want to go? I think it's more of a preference for the player themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But I also would not understand the logic per se, because I think, and again, we all know too, like, you're dealing with 18, 19, 20-year-olds, like, who have been at the higher level of basketball. They're, like, wanting to be the guy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's very honest at this point. You're not going to be the guy in Philadelphia at this time.
Right.
Like, if you do get drafted, it's going to take a while because there's still a pecking order. Like, this isn't a scenario where, like, Joel Embiid essentially has injury issues and you become the guy. Like, well, no, you're still going to be behind Maxie and Paul George and Jared McCain, who had a great rookie season last year.
Yep.
So it's an interesting scenario. But again, I also would not be surprised if there are some voices trying to direct Bailey to go a little bit later in this draft, just so he can be on a team like Washington or New Orleans has, who have essentially come out and said that they will take him if he's available.
Yeah.
That he would be the bigger face of, even if the team is bad. It's the ultimate chicken and the egg question. Like, would you rather be in a worser situation for you basketball-wise but have more money and fame? Or would you rather go to a good team and be put into a better basketball situation, but you will get less money and fame from it?
Yeah. Well, and that is the conundrum that he might be facing here. But one of the many differences between this and the NFL draft, which you and I also covered in real time recently here, is that for Shedeur Sanders, I mean, there was talk ahead of time he could tumble to the late first round, even out of the first round. That seemed a little far-fetched. It went all the way to the fifth. But basically, in the NFL, largely because it is a seven-round affair, when you tumble, that fall can be a little bit steeper than here. Here, where it's a two-round affair, and basically in the second round, as we've talked about on and off, you're looking at, if you get a rotation player, that's great. Players will sometimes swing on upside there, but basically there's a floor essentially here that Sanders didn't end up having in the NFL draft. So, I mean, for Bailey, I don't think it goes past seven because you've got the 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 teams there. Philadelphia, well, Charlotte.
Just to interrupt that.
Yeah.
If he falls to 8, that would be Brooklyn, and obviously he would be taken by Brooklyn anyway, so.
Absolutely, but like but I mean, Brooklyn doesn't get him without a trade up, I don't think. Now, that's the thing. If he's sitting there at 6 or 7, I think the Nets are going to be on the horn. But yeah, Philadelphia, Charlotte, Utah, Washington, New Orleans are the teams directly ahead, and you've got in whatever order. So you've got Bailey, you've got, as you said, VJ Edgecombe, combo guard from Baylor. You got Mr. Nupel here from Duke. The swing man who was paired up with Cooper Flagg this past year, Jeremiah Fears, the combo guard from Washington, and Trey Johnson, a very, very pure shooting guard from Texas. I've got at the top of the next tier here Igor Dimin, who there was a very good piece about him on CBS Sports this week, and it was sort of painting him as a poster child, essentially, of where we are now. This is a guy where, as an international player, may or may not have even come over to play in the NBA, in college basketball to get ready for the NBA, but wanted to because BYU was one of these programs setting up a sort of prototype pro-type system now. Now that you have NIL and now that you have the business considerations there, between that and all of the coaching and development that he received, as well as the off-court aspects here of trying to shape himself for the NBA, that he really painted it as an all-around type situation to kind of get himself ready for the NBA. And yet this is a situation where you've got in the NFL, in the NBA, I suspect in all leagues, sometimes there are players that are in the wrong place at the wrong time. And as much as I've got him at the top of that fourth tier of talent at number 8 overall, looking at the number of teams that may need him to fill a spot here, he may have a little bit of a tumble, possibly to the back end of the lottery, or you heard it here first, maybe even out of the lottery. There's a lot of teams that love him. Now, again, there could be a team to trade up and get him, and there probably should be teams to trade up to get him if he falls. But he's a guy where if teams are very focused on positional needs, he may tumble more than he deserves to.
Right, and he's, you know, he had a great, I mean, like you said, with the whole BYU system, obviously Diabate is the projected number one pick next year, too. So
yes.
Kevin Young's done a great job in this NIL era just having a prototypical pro system, pro-ready system that these guys can come in and play. For me, he's been sort of one of those guys that, depending on the mock draft you look at, he can be as high as 9, 10, and then he, like you said, he could be out of the lottery entirely. He could fall to like 18, 19, 20. He's an interesting player just because if you look at most of the guards in this draft, they're not undersized, but you wouldn't really say any of these guys are like, outside of maybe Dylan Harper, like big. Like, I mean, Dermott's like 6'7", 6'8", and has a decent wingspan. And there's a lot of teams right now, especially in the Eastern and Western conferences, that kind of need that bigger combo guard, because we've seen essentially in the NBA Finals with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Tyrese Haliburton, you can't really have a 6'1", 6'2", guy match up with a dude who has a 6'5", 6'6", reach just over on height. So he's an interesting prospect. Again, I think the real question for him is just his offensive capabilities in the pros. He did shoot relatively well at BYU, very good as distributor. He's kind of, he's like a five-tool guy, but it almost feels more like this draft is very heavily predicated on two things. The one thing is scoring, and the second thing is can you play defense? And I feel like in other years, he might have a higher bit of shine, but it feels more like teams are being very distinct of what they really want from these players moving forward.
I think so. And to get into a little bit of that with this year's draft, just to let everybody know that between now and the NBA draft, we will have, as usual, available on the main page at fantasydrafthelp.com, Pro Hoops Draftology 2025. That is your ultimate guide to the draft, a free download at fantasydrafthelp.com. The positional ratings here, I will preview those right now. The seven different levels here of rankings. This is how I have it. Positions that are great, that would be none. Positions that are very good, shooting guard and small forward. So excellent draft if you're looking to get swing men. The problem with DeMin is that I don't know that there's going to be as many teams that necessarily need to do that. Point guards I have labeled as being good. No positions average, below average, power forward, poor, center, and horrible, none. So as per usual, this is one of these things where, again, if you're sort of a back-to-the-basket big man, then you're playing in the wrong era, sadly enough. So it's one of these deals where there's not a lot of centers in this draft that look like the prototype modern player. I will say, somebody for whom there may be a little bit of hope as far as developing, and if he can develop the skill set that he has already to this point, is a guy who projects to go probably just after the lottery at this point, the center from Maryland, Derek Queen.
Yeah, and he's just one of those guys that I don't really – he's a little undersized at 6'10", 6'11". But he does have a good feel around the rim. He shot decently in Maryland. Like, again, he wasn't shooting the lights out there. But pretty good rebounder, very athletic, can make some plays. Like, again, what we have at least seen so far, Rick, just with the transition of the league right now, is that big guys matter, but if they are not flexible at spreading the floor or at least have the capability of shooting the three, there's not a lot left right now in the league that can essentially be down low and just make plays. Like, you know, we are really just pushing towards a wide open pace and space game now.
Yes.
And you're going to start to see, like, well, there are going to be teams with obviously Wemby sort of improving right now in San Antonio. You're going to start to see teams go after some of these big guys who have that flexibility. Another guy that's been kind of like the other two sort of big guys that a lot of people have been talking about in this draft, obviously Malik from Duke, who was defensively probably one of the best big men in college basketball last year.
Oh, yeah.
But a name that has been sort of really floating around that I've seen go higher in the lottery or go into the lottery or go in the bottom is Danny Wolf from Michigan, who's essentially a guy who can't spread the floor, can't shoot the three, but he's kind of a guy no one knows what to do with, really. Like, but his name has been sort of popcorned about in many mock drafts. I've seen him as high as 12, and I've seen him as low as 25. So he's just one of those weird players that he fits today's game, and distribution-wise, he'll fit for a lot of teams.
Mm-hmm.
But then obviously the question is going to really come down to is, will he be able to consistently hit a three at the NBA level, and will his playmaking abilities be useful? But again, we've also seen in the finals two guys like Miles Turner and Isaiah Hartenstein, who are essentially, I would say, in today's NBA, prototypical big men, guys who can get to the basket, guys who can attempt and make threes at a decent clip. Or essentially, I would say, in at least the case of Hartenstein, like, it would be at least a scenario for him that you can't leave him wide open from three, essentially.
Right.
Or he
and that's worth something.
Making that shot. But I think ultimately the question is going to be is that this is not a great draft for big men, and we're probably going to go into a draft that's probably going to have a lot of top-tier talent. So I feel like a lot of need – it's a weird sort of class, and why I compare it a lot to 2020 is that you have two or three guys who we already know are going to be perceived as top of the class.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a handful of guys who can either be – potentially all-star capable guys or rotational players. But just because we also live in today's day and age in the NBA draft, where you're mainly drafting freshmen and sophomores or Europeans in the first round, there's still not a lot of information on a lot of these guys to a lot of I would say the common basketball fan at this time.
That's right. And as far as Danny Wolf goes, and I'm glad that you mentioned with him distribution, because that's one of the most eye-popping things with him. So this is a thing where, again, as we started to see, I mean, and it's a real unicorn thing, ultimately, what Jokic is able to do in Denver. But you've seen other players to varying degrees, other big men. Obviously, Sabonis, especially after he got to Sacramento, who's really been able to explode that part of his game. Bam Adebayo in Miami, that's one of the things that has helped him ascend to all-star level, is his ability to hit the open man. So Danny Wolf, right, he comes in with that, and that's the thing, that ability for, I mean, again, Jokic is – maybe and Sabonis maybe to a degree. Those are the only guys that you could, you know, use beyond the term secondary playmaker to where they could be a primary playmaker. In today's game.
And at times you saw during the regular season, Şengün and
Şengün too, yeah.
There too. But again, I feel like what we're going to start to see more of and what OKC has been so successful in the finals is using their big guys, whether it's Jalen Williams or Hartenstein as secondary distributors and creators, because what we are seeing, and it's really kind of interesting because this kind of has a little bit of like past within like the triangle, the Tex Winter triangle offense, where you're using big guys essentially to distribute the ball and get better shots for your guards and forwards.
Right.
It's just essentially you're not backing down the paint anymore. Essentially what you're doing is you're putting them in spots or isolation where they are now allowed to make decisions at the point of attack, essentially, in comparison to years ago, where the only time you would be making a decision out of that is if you're backing a guy down and you get double teamed, really.
Right. And there is another article that we have that will be in Pro Hoops Draftology 2025, because we like to have some things in there to kind of take a look at the overall state of the league. So one of the articles that we have in there is simply headlined, Depth is the New Hotness, because we've been talking about this off air. Oklahoma City, Indiana showing it in the NBA Finals, the Cavs, the team with the second best record in the league. This is now becoming a trend, and you and I have been talking about player development a lot the last couple of years, going back to in 2020 again. There's that year again when Denver and Miami were in the Final Four, those being two franchises that have been really at the forefront of the league in the last years, last 10 years or so in terms of player development, and that you're seeing it now. And that, again, we've laughed about this, that it took until the last year or two for every NBA team to have a G League franchise attached to them. Better late than never. But this whole notion now that, and some of us were saying this for a long time, where is it written in stone that especially in the playoffs, you have to be limited to 8-man rotations, 9-man rotations? I did notice that J.B. Bickerstaff this year, I think he had Cade Cunningham was like 21st in the league in minutes per game and nobody else in the top 50. So even J.B. is kind of unclenching the butt cheeks as he goes along here. It is a trend. Kenny Atkinson, of course, with the Cavs, it was kind of night and day as far as what J.B. did the year before, as far as going to 10-man rotations and staying with that. This is a draft where, again, we've talked about this copycat league, the fact that you get past a certain point here and, you know, probably 10, 15, whatever the case may be, then you're looking at probably primarily rotation type guys. If a Danny Wolfe drops to the 20s, then you might have hope for him developing into something more than that. But you're looking at primarily rotational guys at this point. And this is a thing where, again, with this new mentality that the league has, that, hey, we can build out our rotations a little bit deeper. It'll be very interesting to see how that dribbles down to the draft and how teams approach it, potentially different than even a year ago.
Right. And again, we saw essentially what has happened now in the league is that I think a lot of franchises have figured out now that based on the CB, the collective bargaining agreement, mm-hmm. and adding the fact that we have seen a rise in injuries in later in the season in the playoffs over the last 5 years, that your depth is going to be tested in the playoffs, and you're really going to need 8, 9, 10 guys to get you through it. Because at this point, we're in a timeline where anyone on any given couple of games can go on a winning streak. And it feels like what we've seen so far is that teams are now realizing that, very similar to like in Major League Baseball, what now, since they have the G League system now in on every franchise, that they're almost allowed now to start building up a lot of these young talented players, whether it's in Summer League or in the G League, and just get themselves prepped to become NBA players. We've seen a lot of guys, and I'm not even talking about like the superstars. I'm talking about, you know, essentially the guys like the Danny Greens, the Sam Merrills of the world, work through a couple summer leagues and G League time and get themselves to become NBA players, just because there is this ability now that since teams can work internally during their own system, they can now draft to improve their guys and project over time. Because as we have seen, it's very hard to project how a guy is going to do at 19, 20 years old in the NBA. And you're going to need some seasoning to get them up to speed, to get them to be a guy that can be in the rotation when you're 23, 24, 25.
Mm-hmm.
And I think now, since essentially teams now, before it used to be like, if you're drafting a second round pick, it's either because you're trying to save money or you're essentially placing him at the back of your bench at this time.
Right.
But yeah. I think right now what we've seen now too, Rick, is a lot of teams are now deciding, because of, since we have this G League team attached now, we can now go ahead and start producing these guys and using it very similar to like a farm system in Major League Baseball. While certain guys can always just use the additional coaching and the additional help.
Yeah.
You're also setting yourself up for success, because now you can now go and say, hey, you know, we can draft this guy. Normally we wouldn't take him, because if we sit him on the bench in the NBA, he's just not going to gain anything from it. Now with that sort of 1v1 pairing, you're now allowed to take guys you might not have taken or take a bigger risk on, because you now have the opportunity to grow them through your own system instead of what it used to be, which was not all. There were some G League teams, as we knew, that had like 5 or 6 teams assigned to.
Right.
And it got to the point where you weren't really like making guys better. They were just playing together. They were learning basketball, but they weren't getting your system. And I think that's the biggest thing we are seeing now is we saw it with Cleveland. We've seen it with at points Denver with Miami. We also saw it with OKC, and we also saw the growth too in Memphis as well, where giving these younger players time to grow within your franchise is going to pay more dividends. And at the end of the day, end up being cheaper than paying a guy and then having him sit on the bench in the NBA and then essentially him being the first or second cut at the end of the day.
Right. And San Antonio was sort of the 21st century pioneers of this. This is something that Pop Hit was doing back in the day. I remember a couple of years ago, and again, covering prospects as I do, not just for this show and fantasydrafthelp.com, but for the great GoGTS website. I've just been like endlessly amused. This was about maybe 2-3 years ago, and you know, coming across stuff of like, oh, so-and-so was lucky to go to Miami because everything they preach with like heat culture, they actually try to implement that with their G League team. I'm like, well, that's great, and points to Miami. But isn't it really a statement on how stupid the rest of the league is that they're not doing this? Like, if you or I own a franchise, okay, and I'm not saying we know every last thing about basketball. We know a lot, but not everything. That would be one of the first things we would do. Let's have continuity in our developmental system. Let's have a thing where it's like if you get drafted, no matter what investment we've made in you, let's try to get something out of you. Let's try to put you in something that will ready you for if you have to get minutes on our team where you'll be ready to go. And the fact that in the last year or two, the rest of the league has just been like, hey, maybe that's how we should do it. It just it tickles me no end that there were that many dummies out there that didn't figure out that player development and trying for continuity top to bottom in your system should be a basic fundamental precept. And it hasn't been until very recently.
Yeah, and I think also really the reason why for that too on some level is just the game has just changed overall. So you have to develop talent. Like the day, and we've discussed this too in other episodes in the past. Like the days of essentially trotting out three all-stars and having a bench, you know, held together by like duct tape and staples is gone.
Yeah.
Like you have to have guys who are 9, 10, 11 capable at least of holding minutes in the NBA at this time.
Yeah. And so these are the things that teams are thinking about as they're making the picks in this draft here. And I want to mention something also. You sent me a very great video here, actually a couple of them. I want to mention this YouTube channel here, a great NBA analyst. He appears to be dealing a lot on the analytics side, Michael McKelvey, and to spell out his last name, M-A-C-K-E-L-V-I-E. Check out his channel. He's got some pieces on there about inefficiency in the NBA draft in recent years and also in the NFL draft in recent years, among the many analytics-oriented commentaries that he's done there and studies that he's done. And it would be interesting to get a chance to talk to him because one of the things that kind of jumped out at me was, and it was very well put, when he was going through and he was talking about this, and like this year in the NBA Finals, SGA, Haliburton from the 2020 draft again, he went 12th. I mean, so in a sense, that's a sign of inefficiency because these guys are two of the best players in the league and they didn't go super high. But I've got a little bit of a devil's advocate perspective on this because as I see the league succeeding in developing players better than they were previously here, like who's to say if SGA came out 10 years ago or Haliburton that they might not have become all that? So it's a thing where you can say, yes, it was inefficient for the teams that overlooked them that were ahead of them here. But I'm also more inclined to give kudos to the teams that they ended up with. And for SGA, of course, it was the Clippers prior to this. It was first the Clippers and then Oklahoma City. Haliburton, interestingly, also too, Sacramento and then Indiana, both via Paul George in direct or indirect ways, interestingly enough here. But I look at it as these are developmental success stories as well as failures of the teams that passed on them in the drafts, though, both of those years. So I see things a little bit his way, and I see things a little bit my way on that.
I mean, I think one thing that I'm starting to notice, at least with teams, is that, and in the case of both SGA, and it's the same case of Haliburton too, is that they coming out for SGA, it was Kentucky, and for Haliburton, it was Iowa State.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people just didn't know what to do with them initially. Like,
right.
We all knew that Shea was going to be a great player, but there was questions about, well, at the NBA level, was he a three-tier scorer guy? Because most of his right. time at Kentucky was spent in the mid-range, and he was great in the mid-range, and we're seeing it right now.
Yeah.
But the question at his point was, could he become an all-around scoring and be efficient? And for Haliburton, he was kind of like a jack-of-all-trades, master-of-none type scenario. We talked about this in, I believe, our 2020 NBA draft preview of that. Mm-hmm. I personally, I might need to go check the archives, but I was kind of surprised he fell that far. But it wasn't really shocking in the moment. But it feels like to me, too, and to go back to your original point, is that I feel like we're going to start to see, at least in the NBA, we're going to start to see scouts start to wise up a little bit to this nature. Mm-hmm. Just because if you're looking on just a purely scout-related area, is that since we have the, you know, now a bigger depth with the G League assigned to each of these teams, you now have the ability to take guys in a draft and bring them along and give them right. time. And again, it's not really surprising why guys like SGA and Tyrese Haliburton are getting good, because they got into situations where they were allowed to essentially play and lead.
Mm-hmm.
And it shouldn't be shocking that guys who are supremely skilled at the game of basketball can get better over time.
Yeah.
It's just, I think one of the things that has sort of fallen down in this timeline with the NBA draft is that I think teams are now looking more in the thought process, like, these guys aren't finished products. We are really just, we have sort of like key things that we draft around, every team does.
Right.
But it feels like more that we are now going away from players just with like the height, weight measurables, and essentially saying, hey, this guy's really athletic. He's 6'6". He's going to project out into the next level no matter what we do.
Right.
And it's not really, but again, I also see too, the scenarios too with a lot of these teams now is that if we look back at like up since 2017, we have not had a second round draft pick become an all-star. And I feel like one thing that we're seeing now is that teams are now taking a lot more project guys in the second round.
Right.
So while the talent is definitely there,
yeah,
I think teams are now not rushing their second round picks to try to get to that high level. And again, scouting has dramatically improved since 2016, 2017. So it's not yes. surprising that the better players are going sooner. And I'm not going to say that we're going to exist in a world where a guy like a Giannis or a guy like Shea will fall into the later half of the draft and some team will take a chance on him and get it right. It's just, I feel like now GMs and these NBA teams are a little bit more wary about taking a guy just because they like them, essentially. It's much more on what do we think he can become for us down the line.
Yes. And where I think that second round drought is going to end at some point in the next couple of years is because of what you said of teams going for upside with those picks. Probably the prototypical example of that in the last couple of years would be 2 years ago, the Cavs taking Amani Bates, I think, with the 47th overall pick, which his pedigree is, this is a guy that in high school, like LeBron James, was on the cover of Sports Illustrated. So you chase him and you see if you can, you know, suck that, you know, talent out of him, mold him, get him to be that guy that once upon a time you hoped he was going to be. And then again, part of it, in his case with the slide, a big part of it was all the off-court stuff there. And those are the things where, again, those can be very, very difficult to, you know, do something about sometimes, as in the case of Kevin Porter Jr. But if you can solve that part of it, if you can solve maturity issues / character / whatever, and you're left with the gleaming skills that made them a five-star caliber guy prospect in the first place, then you've really got something. So the more teams that are doing what the Cavs did there, one of them's going to hit on a player like that. Truly hope it's the Cavs in my case, but one of them's going to. And I have to say also, too, in terms of SGA sliding a little bit when he came out from Kentucky, I wonder what part of this is, and I wonder if some of this goes to the narrative about certain programs. Because if you think about the timeline of Calipari at Kentucky, I mean, I remember at the time, I wonder how much perhaps he and Devin Booker SGA and Booker may have suffered in terms of guilt by association. Because I remember Michael Kidd-Gilchrist going very high in the draft. What was it, like 2 or 3? And that guy had like a 2-foot shooting radius. I remember at the time I was like, no, don't take him. So I kind of wonder if by the time they came out in the mid to later 2010s, if a little bit of the bloom was off the rose as far as like, well, even the guys that go to Kentucky, they're deemed to be 4- and 5-star prospects. They're not necessarily quite what we were, just because everybody didn't pan out like Anthony Davis, right? I wonder how much of that is the expectations that are attached to a program sometimes, and if you sort of suffer for the people who failed before you.
All right, and I think in it, and this is something that I'll mention just in terms of the NBA, is that I think the more everyone has similar play styles and the whole homogenization of the pace and space era right now, it's a lot easier to draft for that because you're kind of looking for your own sort of archetype guys instead of what used to be, which I would say like in Miami, if you're talking like the mid-2000s going into like 2015, it was a much different time. Like there's a bunch of teams playing a bunch of different styles of basketball, but it feels almost like now that almost all the teams NBA, I'm not going to say play the same style, but it's similar. And again, I feel like it's weird to say this, but it's almost like, I feel like everyone is playing a similar game at least. And because it's very similar, I think these GMs and these coaching staffs at the NBA level are at least now having the ability to be more specialized with their talent on the floor and in their coaching and the player development in comparison to the years past where it used to be, well, we just need to get a big guy so we can stop Shaq, or we need to get a guy who can stop LeBron. Right. Now it's more just like it's a weird scenario. It's more inward-facing than outward-facing, which is a weird thing to say about sports, but it feels like what is happening now more than ever is that teams are now looking internally to building up their roster to compete against these other teams instead of saying, hey, I have to go out there and get this guy that can stop this great player.
Right. And that, again, there is a better way to build a mousetrap if you look hard enough here. I mean, in the NBA, as the game is continuing to evolve, that is the case. Oklahoma City built themselves into a power in the classic sense of it by tanking. But then, as I predicted, it was primarily their own draft picks that would get them back to where they wanted to be. Because as bad as they were going to be for those next couple of years, that's primarily, it's the high picks still, by and large, notwithstanding the exceptions to the rule. Those are the ones that you're going to build around, albeit Jalen Williams, I think he went as low as maybe 11th in the draft the year he went. He was one of the best draft steals, I would say, probably of the last 10 years easily. But by and large, again, you've got to be drafting very high to make that happen. Indiana, again, they were very inventive in how they put this team together, and it was really kind of trial and error. You had Sabonis in there as the second big man with Turner for a couple of years here. They go out and get Halliburton and eventually ascend to the level that they're at. So as far as it goes with Halliburton and the 2020 draft here, since you started us off along those lines and making that point of comparison this year, him going 12th. So let's see if there's anybody that you think that could possibly fall in the footsteps of that. Some of the candidates that I'm looking at potentially, we'd already talked about Demin before. Maybe that's a little bit of a cheat because I have him at the top of my fourth tier of talent, but I think he's somebody that possibly – if he falls into the mid to lower teens, could be that kind of a value. Kasperis Jackosionis, the great combo guard prospect from Illinois, I see him as possibly somebody there. Or Liam McNeely, the small forward from UConn. These are all guys that I would see that if they slide to a certain point somewhere in the teens, I'm not saying that they become as great as Halliburton, but I'm saying that, you know, in the right system, perhaps they can be developed into some facsimile of what he's been able to deliver.
Right. And at least like just the three names that I've seen bandied about, at least Jace Richardson, obviously, at Michigan State, Nick Clifford from Colorado State, and a guy who's been kind of a mystery to a lot of teams right now, Cedric Coward from Washington State. There's a handful of really good young guards in this draft, guard forwards and combo guard forwards in this draft. So it's going to be really, if we're looking ahead, it would not shock me that guys like Jace Richardson, guys like Nick Clifford, I mean, another name for a guy who's been kind of all over the board recently would obviously Nolan Traore of the, look, I'm trying to get remember the Saint Quinn,
yes,
yeah, and it, yes, you're gonna, it's gonna be really interesting because we all know, Rick, we are in yet again a copycat league, and because it's a copycat league, it's gonna be really interesting to see if teams are now going to be focused in on trying to get these combo guards who have the ability to distribute, and in the case of SGA's, be that three-tier level scorer,
yeah,
who can essentially do anything on the floor with. And I feel like as we, there is in this sort of pre, in this Wemby, beginning of the Wemby era, I think a lot of teams are probably going to try their best to not go for big guys. They're going to be much more focused on trying to spread the floor and you, and essentially neutralizing what Wemby does best at this period of time.
Yes, I would think so. Yeah, and again, there is only one Wemby, but as far as trying to identify anything that helps you either match up better with him or provide some, you know, even if it's, you know, 70-80% of what he can deliver, something like that, absolutely. A couple more names here that are interesting. You mentioned Richardson. I've seen him linked to Miami with the 20th pick. I mean, that feels like a classic Heat pick, doesn't it? Like, he feels like a classic example
the
of somebody
who's part of a team that's also been linked to him, as well as OKC. They got Miami's pick at 15. So,
yeah.
I mean, they both, he strikes me as one of those guys where, you know, Cason Wallace is a great player for them right now. And he's probably, I would make an argument, one of the most underrated guards in the league right now.
Sure.
So the one thing I think we did see in this final series so far is that OKC's sort of lack of size or size at the guard position is problematic outside of SGA.
Sure.
So them taking a guy like Richardson, who's a little more athletic, who can maybe be a guy who can guard a couple, you know, two or three positions. And then we also have to consider, too, is that there's going to be – where we also – didn't even talk about topic yet. He's coming back from his ACL. So they're going to get more size. They're going to get more ability on that team. And I feel like, too, if you're just kind of looking at if I essentially am believing like 2025 is the new 2020, at some point, one of these guards or guard combo forwards is going to be a really great player just by default at some point.
Yes. And the player that I'm about to mention, I don't think, with all due respect to him, he's going to ascend to that level, but he's already ascended to a certain draft level beyond where he was at the beginning of March. And you don't always see this. You don't always see whenever somebody gets labeled as, you know, quote unquote, a great college player, when they start to get taken a little bit more seriously as a pro prospect. But we're now seeing the great point guard from Florida, Walter Clayton, ascending to the essentially the bottom of the first round. That's what his value seems to be right about now, which means, and again, with all the trades being made in recent years here, I mean, there are some teams that are going to be, in less advantageous positions that we'll be picking in the 20s. But the odds are pretty strong if Walter Clayton goes in that spot that he's going to go to a really good team. And like Walter Clayton on a good team, a veteran team, feels like a cheat code, doesn't it? Because it's like, I'm not saying that the guy's going to become a star or right off the bat or anything like that. But as far as a valuable piece in the rotation and a guy that knows how to win and is going to fit in with a pre-existing winning culture, like one of those teams is going to do very well if they take him there.
Right. And essentially, if you're looking later on in the draft at that period of time, you have some teams that definitely need that in OKC. Again, they could be a champion again, but you always need more guard help at the end of the day. Brooklyn, yep. Boston, and then I also know that also strikes me as a guy that could also do well in Phoenix in the post-Kevin Durant era. So it's going to be really interesting. I also think, too, that this is kind of an underrated international draft class as well.
I agree.
Yeah, some of the guys that we haven't even mentioned yet, Ben Sarraf or Rana Fasio Alm, has done a lot. There was a lot of discussion, I remember, too, of the 7'4 kid from Brisbane, Rocco's. I think it's Sarkowski,
but yes.
he was apparently, you know, a very interesting player in the NBL, and you know, he has the size when you're 7'4". And then another name that had kind of entered the draft board later on, but then really improved during the timeline at the NBA, you know, essentially at the NBA, at the, essentially the summit in Chicago. mm-hmm. that a lot of people were talking about was Hanson Yang, who is right now projected. He was projected out of the draft to start, but now he's creeping up into the second round. A lot of scouts apparently liked his ability to get to the basket and become a guy who could be another stretch four scenario. So I feel like there's a lot of international guys, like, because we've seen in recent drafts, even though we had literally a draft last year that had three French players taken in the top 15.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like there's not a lot. There's a lot of people sleeping right now on a lot of these European players, and it feels like, and what we'll see this too is like, if we want to say depth and skill set or everything, this is what we do know about overseas players. Like, that is their bread and butter, essentially.
Right. And I do think also, too, in this new world of college sports and where it's headed, and now with the standardization of payment that was settled with the recent NCAA House lawsuit deal, is that I think CBS Sports' article about Demin as a sort of, pet example of where things are going, is that this is one of the last drafts, maybe they'll still be next year, of where we're having to sit here and squint, like, how do we evaluate a kid that played in France versus a kid that played at the upper levels of the NCAA? Because it was not only a thing where once upon a time players that would otherwise play in college might be tempted to go overseas. It didn't happen a whole lot, but it would happen sometimes, but that international players would stay there. I mean, sometimes they'd come over, you know, Olu Candy in the late 90s was one of the earlier ones, I guess, that was a notable example, but like, I think it's going to become standardized. Like, you know, had NIL been in place when Wemby was still developing? Are you kidding me? Like, so it's one of these things where I think it'll only really be the second and third and fourth tier level prospects from here on in that stay international rather than come over to the NCAA past the next year or two, because there's going to be enough money to go around for these kids. And the draw is going to be there, as well as the chance. And I think Demin is going to show it this year. You go to a program like BYU to get you ready for the NBA. You're accomplishing everything you want to accomplish. You're getting paid while you're doing it, and you're getting prepared for the NBA in a way that the scouts and the developmental people can readily understand, versus having to kind of squint at how you're playing in Europe and try to kind of assess how that might fit into the NBA.
Right. And again, we saw, like, obviously at this timeline, the most notable player would be LaMelo Ball.
Yes.
Again, part of the 2020 draft, to play, have a year play overseas and then essentially get that pro level experience. And again, the thing I also noticed too, Rick, with this draft, like we've seen in years past that not a lot of seniors and upperclassmen are getting drafted. Obviously, it's because of the potential of these first round picks that teams are willing to take their risk on. But this is a very laden senior class, essentially, yeah, coming up in the second round. Obviously, the guy that everyone, I feel like, is everyone's favorite old school player, Johnny Broom from mm-hmm. Alabama.
Auburn.
Auburn. There we go.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a couple of other guys who have just kind of been around. Tyrese Proctor was kind of had a little bit of a quiet season overall at Duke, but he could be one of these guys that improves really well in the second round.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but the super senior Vaslav Golden from Michigan, too, is a guy that's an interesting second round pick that could be a guy that could be into the back end of a rotation at the NBA level. And I know, just in case we needed yet another Nebhard, Brian Nebhard has been mm-hmm. a guy that I've seen go in the middle of this second round or later in the draft that, again, has very similar qualities to his brother who currently plays for Indiana. So it's one of those drafts that kind of has – it's a hodgepodge of everything right now. I feel like we know what we're going to get with Cooper Flagg, but we really mm-hmm. just don't know about any of these other players, about where their ceiling is. And I think that's what makes it very similar to the 2020 draft, where we knew what Anthony Edwards and LaMelo Ball were capable of.
Right.
But a lot of those other guys in that same class, we did not know. And a lot of them are now either in NBA rotations or, in the words of Tyrese Haliburton, in the NBA finals.
Oh, yeah. And in my evaluation that I'm doing in Pro Hoops Draftology 2025, again, it'll be available on the main page at fantasydrafthelp.com. I have it evaluated that when you look at Cooper Flagg, so he's one of these guys at the top of the draft, you know, like Wemby, like Zion Williamson the year that he came out. Interesting how that turned out. Like Cade Cunningham. There are certain guys that were obvious number one picks overall. Dylan Harper is a guy that I think would have gone number one overall in the other drafts of the last couple of years, probably last year, probably 2022, could have been in 2020. He would have been in play. But I think the guys on the next level could have even been in play for number one overall last year or 2022, maybe not ahead of Anthony Edwards in 2020, but whether it be Bailey, Edgecombe, Neupel, Fears, or Johnson, I feel like any of those guys would have been in that mix. Remember how fluid it was last year? There was a couple of guys at the top. Who's it going to be? Like, I think those guys could have fit in there pretty well, potentially. But that's where, again, in looking at this, a lot of it is going to come down to where do they end up? Do they end up in the right kind of system to develop them? And you see, you saw it in the NFL this past season. Once Sam Darnold got out of the vortex of, you know, Jets, Panthers, whatever, you put him in a legit system like the Vikings and you see what he can do. This happens all the time in the NBA as well, where players are sometimes lucky or unlucky based on where they end up. And you mentioned Broome. He's another guy like Clayton where – not a real high ceiling, but a super high floor, and a guy that's a winner and a guy that's going to fit in and be a high-end rotation player, I think. Again, particularly if he's lucky enough to go to a really good team. He's more likely to drop to the second round. He might end up on one of these bottom feeder teams, and then I don't know what happens to him. But he's sort of the classic example of if he ends up on the right team. I mean, imagine if he ends up in Boston where they're transitioning over the next couple of years, right? The opportunities that he's going to get there. I mean, as a Cavs fan, I don't want any part of that. I don't want to see that guy become an impact guy coming off the bench. Again, high floor kind of a guy to give you quality minutes. Nobody that hates the Celtics should want to see that happen.
And I mean, I think the real question we have at this point too is with some of these guys who I mentioned and you mentioned too are just older players who have a lower ceiling. The thing we've learned, especially in the NBA these days, is rotation players are needed now more than ever. Mm-hmm. And I always like to think a guy who's had 3 or 4 years of college basketball under their belt knows these scenarios much better. And that's you're right. Going to see guys who are in the second round going to become impact players for sure. Mm-hmm. And it feels like just with Rom, just his entire career at Auburn has been him essentially helping lead that Tigers team and essentially being sort of that interior force who can make plays to get block shots and be athletic. And I think, as we have seen in the playoffs, those guys are very hard to come by. Mm-hmm. And it feels like there will be a team, whether they trade back or they try to trade up and get him. I don't think anyone's going to take him in the first round. He's probably a high second round pick at this point.
Right.
But he probably, out of the guys who are going to be taken later, has probably the highest probability, outside of maybe I would make the argument of like Nembhard, of
right,
a guy who can make an impact on the next level right away and can help fill in the back end of your rotation.
He's safe. Yeah, he can come in. He's safe. You kind of know what you're going to get. He's never going to make an all-star team. But again, he is safe in that way. And that's where, again, as we go through here, it's going to be very fascinating to see how this shakes out. Of course, you and I will be back doing this in real time on draft night, June 25th. Any additional thoughts that we didn't get to yet from you, Ben, on this year's draft class?
Not really, but at some point we got to talk about Dink Pate finally getting drafted in the NBA at some point. But you know,
yeah,
he's been in the G League. He was all up on Shaq's reality show with Reebok. So if this could be Dink's year, and he's a very interesting prospect, a little bit undersized, but has great athletic ability and played really well when he was at G League Ignite when it still existed. So he's one of those guys that's right now at the back end of the second round or in the way around, who I feel like, given his age, he's only 19 years old, and he has now 2 years of G League experience. He strikes me as a guy you take a flyer on, and he becomes a guy who can impact the floor at some point in his career.
Yes. Yeah, and that's worth something, too. Again, in this NBA, as we're talking about here, and we've spent, I think, probably equal times talking here today about the draft class and how they fit into this evolving state of the NBA, again, if you can fit anywhere into a 10-man rotation and really bring a skill set the teams need, that you're going to be in a good spot here, because as teams are seeing the wisdom in deviating from the tight 8-man rotations or even 9-man rotations to 10-man rotations, right now with 30 teams in the league, I mean, that's an extra 30 bodies that are needed if the average team goes from relying on 9 guys to 10 guys. And ultimately, when you're looking at injuries being factored in through the course of the year, even beyond that, potentially some teams wanting to have 11 guys or maybe even 12 guys that they can count on a quasi-regular basis. And we're seeing that it can be done without sacrificing the rhythm of the players involved. That was always an excuse for not doing it. Oh, they'll be out of rhythm if we do this, and they need to get their minutes and their touches. Well, yes and no. I mean, it all kind of depends how you run your offense and how you try to factor that in on this here. But teams are going deeper. Teams are needing more bodies. It'll be fascinating to see how the evolving state of the NBA factors into this year's draft. But again, we'll be checking it in real time. As always, a pleasure, Ben Chu. Thank you so much for your great hoops analysis, my man.
Thank you. I appreciate it as always. Thanks, Rick.
Great to have you here, Ben. I really appreciate you being here. Thank you so much. And thank you, everybody, for checking out FDH Lounge mini episode 1839.